Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later this hour, we'll talk about how the Trump tariffs are affecting Bay Area businesses. How are they impacting your life? Then, did you know that the Bay Area has a dance week? It's happening from April 25th to May 4th, and we'll learn all about it. But first, earlier this month, San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie unveiled a rezoning plan that would allow taller buildings along some of the city's key transit corridors. The proposal could bring major changes to neighborhoods that haven't seen much new housing in decades, and it's already sparking strong reactions, both for and against. Joining us now to break it all down is J.K. Dineen. He covers planning and development for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to State of the Bay, J.K.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, delighted you could be here. So for people who don't know about this rezoning plan, can you give us some highlights about what it is proposing to do?
So basically, they're trying to encourage housing to be built in neighborhoods where it hasn't been built in the last 30 years. So not Transbay, not SoMa, not Civic Center, but rather the west side of town, the Sunset, the Richmond, the Marina. The new version of it has a bunch of new housing that would be allowed in sort of the Fisherman's Wharf area, or, you know, sort of North Beach, along the flatlands there, like Bay Street and North Point. Also sort of Gary and Masonic. People used to call that Mervyn's Heights back when there was a Mervyn's there and a Toys R Us. I remember.
Yes, I remember those.
but yeah, so it's kind of, you know, it's an effort to build housing in parts of the city that have been resistant to it for the last, you know, 20 years.
Well, Mayor Lurie is labeling this a, quote, family zoning plan. His critics are just calling it straight up upzoning. Tell us, I mean, I think it's a smart way to pitch it, but is it or not?
I mean, they made some changes that, when I say they, I mean the Lurie administration, made some changes that maybe, you know, they hope will make it more palatable to single family home owners in the Sunset and the Richmond, which is that they're not increasing heights in general on residential blocks, but they're increasing, it's called density decontrol. So the height stays the same, which is generally 40 feet. And the rear yard exception stays the same. So you still have to have like the same envelope that you would have under our current zoning, but you can do more units. So if you can squeeze two units or three units into the same envelope, you can do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's sort of like, that's why maybe they're saying like, this isn't a big upzoning. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, there are areas that are being upzoned, like a lot of people from Jordan Park have been complaining because the heights along like around Geary and Masonic, you know, would go up to 300 feet. North Beach, which I mentioned, the Marina on, you know, on Chestnut Street, they would allow 6-story buildings. On Lombard, they would allow 8-story buildings. So yeah, there's definitely like things that are very concerning to people who, you know, own property and like things the way they are and like the San Francisco historic neighborhoods and all that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what is the pressure on San Francisco to build more housing? I mean, obviously we have a housing shortage. Is it because the state is breathing down the city's neck?
Basically. Yeah. I mean, that's the, I mean, I think maybe when this conversation all started, it was pre-COVID, honestly. And like what the conversation back then was like, you know, we have a city that's just bursting at the seams. We have so many people that want to live here. Rents are going through the roof. Small businesses are getting driven out. Artists, activists, all kinds of people that we want here were not able to live here anymore. People were moving to Oakland. And the conversation is sort of, I mean, I would say the tone is still the same, although, like, since then, like, a lot has changed, right? Like, rents have gone down 20% in some neighborhoods. We've lost 30 to 40,000 people. But how long that's going to last, who knows? But meanwhile, yeah, so the state is requiring 82,000 units to be planned for between 2023 and 2031. That includes about 36,000 new units that would be part of this rezoning, so that we need to rezone for 36,000 units. The rest of the 82,000 units would be covered through projects that are already approved. We have a lot of projects that are approved, whether it's the shipyard or Schlage Lock or Balboa Reservoir or India Basin, or I mean, there's massive projects all over the city that are fully entitled, ready to go, but haven't started. So.
We've heard so much about downtown, and that one of the problems of our downtown, the financial district, is that it's mostly office space and not enough residential mixed into it, whereas other big cities have a combination of both. Does this proposal have anything? I mean, you mentioned that SoMa is not included, but I mean, is this upzoning or this family plan thinking about downtown in any way?
No, I mean, all of those areas are upzoned, and the city has done so much to make it cheaper and easier for owners of like office buildings or like downtown parking lots to, we've lowered the affordable housing requirement. We've lowered fees. We've removed obstacles as far as entitlements and going through the approval process with the planning commission and all that. Like, so this is really not focused on downtown. It's kind of like the anti-downtown plan.
Is this going to create more affordable housing, housing for families with two or three kids? Or is this just going be, or is the idea that so much housing will be built that the market will, on its own, level out to a place where rents are not so crazy?
I mean, ironically, like the sort of the zone, the predecessor, the state Senate bills that have been passed that to get rid of obstacles and to get rid of planning commission and get rid of CEQA review have been really focused on everything, but the only projects that have taken advantage of it have been affordable projects. There's really no interest among market rate developers in this plan. I mean, maybe there will be someday, but none of the market rate developers have showed up at the meetings or spoken out on behalf of, their interests. And basically, the developers I'm talking to are saying, like, we don't have a zoning problem, we have an economics problem. And there's nothing that the city could do around zoning to make us want to build. So it's a little bit of an exercise. I mean, now, but what the mayor says and what Rich Hillis, the planning director, says, and what pro housing people like Scott Weiner say is that it's not a 10-year. I mean, the RENA cycle that we're required to produce 82,000 units, that expires in 2031. We produced 1,000 units last year. Is not likely to increase very much. There's nobody building anything. You could give land away, you could have no zoning, and nothing's going to get built for a few years. But I mean, someday, yes, San Francisco will be, we're a boom and bust city.
And when
So
you
it's smart for the activists to, like, make sure that we have a lot of protections in place for small business, for rent control tenants, for communities of color, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when just to unpack that a little bit, when you say market rate developers are not really interested in building more housing, the headwinds they're facing are high interest rates and construction costs. Is that right?
Sorry, yeah, but I mean, I covered the Rincon Hill plan. I covered the Market Octavia plan. I covered the West SoMa, the Trans Bay, the Eastern Neighborhoods, the Balboa Reservoir. Some of those plans actually like did take place during recessions, the Great Recession. And yet during those periods of time, developers were very much like piggybacking on the plans. They were buying up sites, they're putting sites into contract, they were meeting with city planners, trying to get ahead, trying to figure out what the eventual zoning would be. We're seeing none of that. We're seeing no developers seem the slightest bit interested in this plan, which has been, both concerning and interesting, but that's short-sighted. I think it's smart for the Race and Equity and All Planning Coalition, which is like the progressive group that's monitoring this, to like look beyond that, because obviously San Francisco is an attractive city. We're gonna become a place again where a lot of capital wants to come in and make money, and so looking out for protections, even though it doesn't seem very smart right now or very important right now, eventually it will be.
Well, I just want to quickly read this email from a listener that we received before the show. They wrote, "Neighborhoods United SF, a coalition of 60 and more community groups, strongly opposes upzoning as a planning tool. With 70,000 units already approved and 140,000 more allowed under current zoning, why sacrifice our small-scale neighborhoods instead of focusing growth downtown? San Francisco is a city of human-scale, village-like communities, and we won't fix affordability by giving speculators free rein." Just curious, JK, is this similar or consistent with some of the criticisms you've heard of the plan?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And it makes sense. And people that have lived through booms in this town and SoMa and the Mission before the pandemic, and there people are right to be concerned. But at the same time, if you look at where are rents the most expensive? They're the most expensive in places we haven't built in 40 years. Where are rents the cheapest? They're the cheapest in areas like Civic Center and SoMa that had tons of, I mean, they're down 20 to 30% from pre-COVID in some of these, big buildings and, these neighborhoods. I mean, there's other factors involved. There's crime and there's street conditions and there's work at home and all that kind of thing. But the fact is, we haven't tested it. We don't know what it would be like to build 2,000 units, in the Richmond.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to leave it there. And I mean, stay tuned for what might happen next. Jake and Deneen is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle who covers planning and development. Thanks for joining us, JK.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll sit down with a panel to discuss how the Trump administration's tariffs are affecting Bay Area businesses, consumers, and the economy. Stay with us.
Crosscurrents is off tomorrow for Earth Day, but tune in to KALW for a full day of the sounds of nature. You're hearing Drake's Bay at Point Reyes National Seashore, and the audio came from an episode of Natural State with Marissa Ortega Welch. And you'll hear more sounds all day tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Mahogany. I'm 14, and I'm a youth member at RISE. Come out to our Be a Kid fundraiser on April 25th. For tickets and information, go to risecenter.org. That's risecenter.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Donald Trump has described his tariffs as, quote, medicine for American industry. But so far, they've disrupted global markets and created uncertainty for both companies and consumers. Tonight, we're taking a closer look at what these tariffs could mean for the Bay Area, especially for local businesses still working to recover from the pandemic. Joining me now to help unpack these issues and more, I'm delighted to welcome Lauren Crabb. She's the founder and owner of Andytown Coffee Roasters. Welcome to State of the Bay, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, and I love the plover drink there at Andytown. A huge fan. We're also welcoming back Rodney Fong. He's the president and CEO of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. Nice to have you again, Rodney.
Thank you, Grace.
We've got Ted Egan. He's the chief economist for the City and County of San Francisco. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, Grace.
And we've got Neil Mahoney, director of the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research and a professor of economics at Stanford. Thanks for joining us, Neil.
Great to be on the show.
It's an all-star cast, what can I say? And before we begin, we want to hear from you. If you're a business owner, have you already felt the effects of the tariffs? And how are you planning to minimize their impact? If you don't own a business, are you worried that tariffs are going to lead to higher prices for you? We're taking emails now at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can find us on social media. And, you know, there's always the phone. So give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Are you putting off a major purchase or are you having to change your business plans? We'd love to know. Neil, I wanted to start with you to get a big picture view. I mean, tariffs have been in the news since January, for most of the campaign, because Donald Trump loves a tariff. Where do things currently stand with tariffs? There have been a lot of rapid changes since they were first introduced. Tell us what we can expect in the next few weeks.
Yeah, so it's a mess. I follow this professionally, and I can barely keep up. High level, you know, there are tariffs in place on certain categories of goods, so steel, autos. There are 10% universal tariffs on every country and some islands inhabited by penguins. There are, you know, huge tariffs on China, and there's some exclusions, electronics in particular. So that's the current lay of the land. And then these very large reciprocal tariffs, you know, were paused for 90 days. So I think we're something like 70 days out from when they could come into effect, but there might be negotiations, tremendous uncertainty for consumers and for businesses.
Well, Lauren, I wanted to get your perspective. I mean, you run Andytown Coffee Roasters, you're a business owner, and certainty is something that all business owners like. What are you faced with right now, and how are you trying to plan around the future?
It has been a challenge. So having a coffee roasting company, we are uniquely affected by these tariffs because coffee as an agricultural product cannot be grown in the continental United States. The notable exception in the U.S., of course, is Hawaii, but Hawaii couldn't handle the entire coffee industry and demand in the United States. So we are sourcing an international product, and so there is no real, you know, we're looking at this and there's no real alternative for us to buy coffee here in the US. So when we're talking with our international partners, they are facing a ton of uncertainty, and we are as well, especially with our partners in the likes of Indonesia and Thailand, who are facing, you know, potentially up to 30-35% tariffs. So it is very challenging. We also face the challenge of packaging. So most of the products that you see made here in San Francisco, if they are sourcing compostable or highly biodegradable products, they are most likely sourcing them from China or Taiwan. Taiwan is where we source our coffee bags from. So we're facing these tariffs on the ingredient side, and then we're also facing them on the packaging side.
And I mean, we've heard a lot about how tariffs are basically a tax. As a business owner, I mean, how do you weigh this idea of, should I pass the cost on to the consumer? Should I absorb this cost myself? I mean, what's your calculus?
So as a business owner, so coffee and the service industry in general, we're a very small margin business. We don't have a lot of wiggle room in terms of absorbing higher costs. And that said, we're selling $5, $6 products. And so we take it very seriously when we do have to raise our prices, because the last thing we want to do is to, pass that on to our consumer who we're hoping is visiting us on a daily or weekly basis. And we take it very seriously when we do have to raise our prices. Previously, we've had to raise our prices for a number of reasons. My favorite reason to raise my prices is because I'm paying my people more or I'm giving them better benefits. My least favorite reason to raise my prices is, this sort of arbitrary reason because one person said they want to increase my costs,
Oh, what do you want consumers to know about your business and what you're thinking about? I mean, you have a loyal following. Andytown has a few outlets in the city. What do you want them to know about the troubles and the concerns that you're facing?
I think it's important to understand that coffee is a global product. And so when you're going to your neighborhood coffee shop and you know your local barista and they know your name and your order and everything, it feels very local and it feels like it is something that is just you and in your neighborhood. But, behind the scenes, we are doing a lot of work on this global scale. And so, we face global crises all the time, whether it's a drought in Brazil or, labor crisis in Guatemala. We do see our prices fluctuate throughout the year based on those external factors, and most of them are very far out of any of our, individual control. We try our best to communicate that to customers, and we also try our best to tell the stories of our farmers. And so our farmers are working so hard to make sure that their coffee is delicious, and we're working really hard on our end to make sure that we're brewing it and giving it the justice that it deserves. And so when we have this something like a tariff, it is so far out of left field, and it is something that our farmers can't control, we can't control, and we're just kind of, crossing our fingers and hoping that there's some sanity comes back to this administration. Or, doesn't come back, starts to come to begin with, that they can realize that it's not just the car manufacturers that are going to be, building new factories or whatever. It's like we can't buy coffee from anywhere else.
Right.
So that we have no choice. So when we're looking for alternatives, there are none.
Well, it's so good to hear from a local perspective. That was Lauren Crabb. She's the owner of San Francisco's Andytown Coffee Roasters. And if you go buy one, make sure you get a London Fog Latte because there's nothing more delicious. Thanks so much for joining us, Lauren. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Neil, I wanted to go back to you. I mean, San Francisco has a lot of small businesses, from cafes like the ones Lauren owns and to corner stores and retail shops. I mean, these smaller operations, we talk a lot in the news about the big car manufacturers or the refrigerators or the major huge like iPhones or whatever that are going to be affected by tariffs. But really, when it comes down to it, most of America is run on small businesses, and these small business owners are really going to feel the pinch.
Yeah, no, that's completely right. And I think Lauren's story is only one example of what we'll see across restaurants and retail and many other small businesses. A key point that comes up all the time when I'm talking about tariffs is our imports, 40% of them are inputs into the goods that our companies produce, be it the big auto manufacturers or other large businesses, but also coffee at your local coffee shop or avocados at your local restaurant, that these tariffs are a tax on our businesses. And so instead of helping those businesses, often it will raise their costs and make it harder for them to get by.
Well, I'm thinking when you said avocados, I'm thinking of Tacolicious, which is a very popular taco chain here, and they've added chickpeas to their guacamole, much to people's dismay, just because of this. Yeah. And I will say I had it the other night, and it was tasty. I mean, it tasted like a guacamole. Rodney, I wanted to turn to you because this is what the Chamber of Commerce thinks about, the health of its local businesses. And what are you hearing from your members right now?
Yeah, Grace, you know, we think these taxes are hurting San Francisco, not helping San Francisco's economy. And, you know, San Francisco's unique. We're a service city, we're a hospitality city, and all of these additional fees and taxes and tariffs are going to end up basically a tax on Americans, a tax on San Franciscans. And we're trying hard. I think all of us are trying to make San Francisco a more affordable city, but in fact, it's actually creeping up. So our members are frustrated, as I think Ted Egan mentioned, the predictability is so, so important for any kind of business to be able to forecast what's going to happen. And you can imagine when we have businesses that are trying to look forward 4 to 6, 9 months out, purchase things, they're not sure if costs are going to go up. And I think, like Andytown, it doesn't want to raise prices if it doesn't have to. So the unpredictability is really concerning.
Do you hear from some of your members that they might add a line on the receipts, like tariff tax?
I haven't heard of tariff tax, but I'm sure many of them are forced, not wanting to raise prices. But in some cases, you know, there are subscription models or season passes where the prices have been established for the entire year, and so there's no opportunity to raise that price. However, the choice that they have is actually to reduce the service to some degree. So that's concerning. But, you know, overall, the tourism industry in San Francisco, the construction industry in San Francisco is important, but we don't really manufacture anything large. And so I think we are uniquely different. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who is traditionally very conservative, actually comes out and says that this is a tax on Americans. And we have to agree in San Francisco that this is a tax on San Franciscans.
Well, I do recall that the Wall Street Journal called this trade war the dumbest trade war in history. And Ted Egan, I wanted to turn to you. You're the city and county's chief economist, and San Francisco's downtown is still trying to recover from the pandemic. Foot traffic is down. Office occupancy hasn't fully rebounded. What impact are these possible tariffs having to the city's recovery? What are you estimating?
Well, I mean, I think just to echo what everyone else on the panel has said, at the very least, it's a major dose of uncertainty to a downtown economy that doesn't need any more uncertainty, that's already dealing with issues like still the lingering effects of the shutdown and the tech layoffs and, of course, work from home. You know, these tariffs, I'm sure Neil can tell you, are not good for the U.S. economy as a whole. They don't net out as a positive. That's why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and conservative economists are against them. They're particularly bad for a region like the Bay Area or San Francisco that's been so successful in the last 30 years of increased globalization and trade. We're one of the most successful regions in the United States at serving export markets. And this tariff, this trade war, is really, we're talking about it from the import side. It's going to have major impacts on Bay Area exporters too, in a couple of ways. It's going to invite retaliation from some of our major trading partners, which are significant sources of revenue for these companies. And it's also, as we've seen over the past month, it's affecting the stock market and it's affecting the investment that the city needs in order to continue to grow. So again, I'll just echo what other folks are saying. I don't see a real silver lining in this for San Francisco.
Yeah, there's just a huge ripple effect. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Eric from Berkeley, and he owns a business in Oakland. Eric, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you so much. I own Games of Berkeley. It's a 45-year-old retail store for tabletop games and a number of other kind of person-to-person activities. And I'd like to echo some of what I've heard already about the uncertainty, especially about a month ago, we got a notice from one of our suppliers saying hey, as of such and such date, we are going to increase our prices by 10%. And then by May 1st, we're increasing our prices by 25%.
Wow.
Literally just today, I got a follow-up email from them saying, well, we're not actually raising our prices again as of May 1st, but we're going to monitor it, and then any other changes we'll announce as of June 1st. And that's just one of the suppliers. I've been paying a lot of attention to how these tariffs are affecting our industry, all the publishers, creators, manufacturers, and it has completely rocked the tabletop game industry.
Well, I mean, first of all, Games of Berkeley is an amazing store, and it would be a tragedy if Settlers of Catan was going to cost more than it already does. I mean, Eric, how does this affect your ability to plan, make a business plan for your own business when you don't know if the price is going to be 25% higher or not?
Well, we have to make some kind of best guess estimates. We have looked over the past couple of months at the announcements that we're getting from a variety of our suppliers, and so we come up with kind of an aggregate amount that everything is likely to be increased by. And as of about the past week and a half, we've actually been raising prices across the board in the store so that when we get to that point, some of those prices have already increased, but when we get to the point where they're finally actually hitting, then we'll actually have enough money to restock. Some of our peers in the industry managed to come out of this past holiday season with a pretty significant war chest, and they're doing things like stocking up an entire year's worth of product. Wow. In some cases, ahead of time. In a couple of their cases, they are now, of course, having to find storage for all of that product, which is something they had never really had to worry about before.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a call. And again, that's Eric, who is the owner-operator of Games of Berkeley, which is, again, I feel like I'm plugging all the guests that we have, but that is a particularly fantastic store.
thank you.
Neil, Eric has brought up this point that consumers are going to be as affected as business owners. And I just am curious, we know that prices will be higher, but is that going to depress, or is there concern that that's going to depress the desire of consumers to buy things? I mean, we have a consumer-oriented economy.
Yes, so there's a lot of concern right now. You know, we started the year with an economy that was, I think, an envy of our peers in the developed world. Strong economic growth, low unemployment rate, including for minorities and young people who are typically the sort of last folks to get a job. And now, you know, you look across the banks and other forecasters and their projections for the likelihood of a recession are a coin flip. And so why are they concerned? It's because in the face of this uncertainty and potential price increases, that lots of people in the economy are going to press pause. Companies who are thinking about hiring or expanding, they're going to press pause and wait and see how the tariffs play out, how the economy is going to shake out. Consumers who are concerned about whether they'll have a job or what prices will be in the future may hold back a little bit. And that makes sense for every individual actor. The problem is if everybody presses pause at the same time, suddenly you don't have enough spending in the economy to support all the businesses. And so you generate this self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I think all of the professionals who are doing the forecasting are very worried that the uncertainty and the price increases are going to cause a major slowdown, if not a recession, over the next 6 to 12 months.
You know, Ted, tourism is such a big economic engine for the Bay, for San Francisco. Manufacturing is not, as Rodney and you mentioned earlier. What sectors are going to be hard hit by these tariffs, do you think, that will really impact San Francisco's economy?
Well, one of the things that is directly exposed to imports is construction. We particularly got a lot of imports from Canada. And it looks like Canada is sort of not in the crosshairs at the moment, but we have a lot of lumber exports there. But I think, you know, the panelists said this earlier. I think Neil said this earlier. They work their way into everything we buy. And that's why we're looking at cost increases, even for the things that we don't directly import, even the things that we get from American producers. If they get things from imports, then that price increase is going to be reflected into us. In the particular case of tourism, it's a challenging one. And Rodney may be able to say more about it than me. It's challenging because a lot of it has to do with not direct tariff barriers, but really what's the desire to come and visit San Francisco? You know, San Francisco is an iconic American city. If you're not feeling the love for the United States at the moment, maybe you'll have second thoughts about a visit to San Francisco. It does look like these trade policies are bad news for the dollar, and a cheaper dollar might attract tourism. But I'd be surprised if that was a major effect, and I'd be more worried about kind of the brand issues concerning with people wanting to travel to the United States in this environment.
Well, Rodney, I want to turn to you on tourism, but before I do that, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about how local businesses and the Bay Area economy will be affected by the Trump administration's tariffs. We have the director of the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy and Research, Neil Mahoney, San Francisco's chief economist, Ted Egan, and the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce president and CEO, Rodney Fong. And we're taking your calls and questions, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. I mean, Rodney, you are focused on tourism in the city. Tell me what your concerns are.
Yeah, Grace, you know, we think that tourism is being directly undermined by the tariffs. We saw a direct decline from Canadian visitors into California and to the U.S. immediately after the tariffs discussions with Canada. San Francisco, I think, saw a 13% reduction in airlift from Canadian visitors, which is a big market for us. And Visit California, which is the marketing agency for the state, predicts that foreign tourism is going to drop by about $6 billion this year alone. That's a huge chunk of our economy, a big piece. And, you know, if I could maybe just kind of go a little further downstream in all of this conversation, I think there's concern about the supply chain. And when people make panic buys or pre-buy or stop buying and put things on pause, you can imagine that the other people on the other end of that order are in business as well. And their unpredictability becomes a factor. And so the supply chain globally, I think, goes off kilter. One thing that we noticed through COVID is that it's very easy to disrupt business and supply chain, and it takes a long time to get it back. It takes years, maybe even generations, for business to build up where they are. So any little bump in the road has long-lasting impacts.
Mm. Neil, I want to go back to you. I mean, Trump has been talking about tariffs, I think, since the 1980s, as far as I can tell, and he is obsessed with the trade deficit. How problematic is the trade deficit, and is this doing anything to solve that?
I think, you know, most economists, because virtually all economists, don't think there's any problem with a bilateral trade deficit, you know, a deficit between one country and another. You know, the famous story is, you know, an economist saying, "I have a trade deficit with my hairdresser, that, you know, they provide me haircuts and I only provide them money in return." That's not a problem. And, you know, that analogy applies. I do think, you know, There are issues about industrial capacity in the United States and the resilience of our supply chains, our ability to weather shocks, especially in any geopolitical event. So there are reasons why we want to be able to build out sort of critical goods manufacturing and supply in the United States. But tariffs are, I think, not the solution to this problem. And I think there's pretty much across the board agreement with that sentiment.
Well, the tech sector, Niels, seemed to catch a little bit of a break when the Trump administration exempted smartphones, computers, some other electronic devices from reciprocal tariffs. I think it's hard to prognosticate about what the administration might do, but do we think that that's going to last, or will these products be hit again?
I think it's really hard to know. I think some of the leading predictors, do think that there will be sectoral tariffs on electronics. They may not be as large as the 145% tariffs on China now in place, but that there will be tariffs here. And it's similar to Lauren Crabb talking about coffee. I think there's a set of goods that the United States, isn't able to produce domestically. And I think we've all seen these memes of Wall Street bankers, screwing in the tiny screws on iPhones. I don't think this is a well thought out plan that would lead to the types of jobs that Americans actually want.
Neil, I wanted to stay with you for one second. Governor Newsom has floated the idea of seeking exemptions for California-made exports from trade retaliation. I mean, is that going to actually work, or is that just political posturing?
I tip my hat to Newsom to trying to do whatever he can in his power to protect Californian consumers and businesses. He sued the Trump administration, questioning the grounds that they implemented some tariffs. So we'll see where that ends up. Like you said, he has sort of reached out to other countries to ask them that if they retaliate, they would exclude California. It's going to be difficult. I think there's no precedent that I know of retaliation excluding a specific state. Now, what you do see is when retaliation is designed, it is designed to inflict the maximum pain on the administration in power's constituents. And so I think the case for optimism is that if you want to exert maximum pain on the Trump administration, that you won't be targeting California, you'll be targeting other industries and other regions of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard whiskey from Kentucky and Harley Davidson's from Wisconsin are hot on France's list. Rodney, we have a minute and a half left, and I want to give you the last word. What are your Chamber of Commerce members talking to each other about how to protect themselves and plan for the future?
Yeah, I think a lot of us are reevaluating our performas, looking at our business plans, remaining optimistic. But you also see them reacting and being conservative and not making those decisions. So, I really do hope that the federal government begins to look at small business. And at least in San Francisco, small businesses are businesses that have 100 employees or less. That's quite large. But I'm curious, and we've always talked about small businesses being the backbone of America. I really think it's a barometer and it's something to watch whether businesses are closing, opening, shrinking, hirings are growing or shrinking. And it'll begin to tell us how these tariffs affect us here in San Francisco.
Well, there's so much more to cover, and I'm afraid that's all that time we have for tonight. We've been joined by Neil Mahoney, director of the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy and Research. He's also a Stanford professor of economics. Rodney Fong, president and CEO of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. Ted Egan, chief economist for the City and County of San Francisco. And earlier, we were joined by Lauren Crabb, founder and owner of Andytown Coffee Roasters. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks for being on State of the Bay. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from my co-host Ethan Elkind. He's got an interview with Wayne Hazard, the force behind Bay Area Dance Week. It starts in just a few days, and you'll want to cha-cha-cha your way right back to that.
On Your Call, we talk about current events, politics, arts, and the media. We're always thinking about ways people can get involved and make change. And we want your knowledge and experience in the mix. I'm Rose Aguilar. Join the conversation on Your Call weekdays at 10 a.m. on KALW. Or make your voice heard anytime. Email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or tweet at Your Call Radio.
It's Earth Week on KALW, and Baymade is sharing episodes from three climate justice podcasts, Earth Riot, Rising Tide, and Climate Shifted, plus the sounds of the natural world. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. to Baymade, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Welcome back. This is Ethan Elkind. This spring, the Bay Area will once again come alive with rhythm, movement, and community. Bay Area Dance Week, now in its 27th year, is back from April 25th through May 4th. And with more than 200 free performances, classes, and workshops, there really is something for everyone. And joining us now is Wayne Hazard, Executive Director of Dancers Group, the organization behind Bay Area Dance Week, and a longtime leader in making dance accessible and inclusive across the region. So Wayne, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Wayne, let's start with the big picture. First of all, for those who are not familiar, what is Bay Area Dance Week? And what, in your view, makes it such a unique celebration in the arts world?
Bay Area Dance Week is a 10-day festival that will happen starting April 25th. And the uniqueness of it is that it really models how we are in the Bay Area in terms of different cultures, different bodies, different ways of being in the world. And the festival really allows the dance community to open their doors, similar to, say, what the visual arts community does, to say, come in, experience what we have. It's free. So whether it's a performance, a class, an experiential workshop, folks can take a chance and see how they might enter into dance. Even if they see a lot of dance, they might go, hey, I've never seen this folklorico company in the Mission District. Or, hey, I live in San Jose. I'm going to go to Eastridge Mall and see 20 or 30 different dance entities during the course of the day and do some shopping as well. So there's so many diverse ways you can enter the festival.
And Wayne, you just mentioned a few of them, but can you name some of the groups that are involved and some of the locations?
Sure. There's we have Dancing in the Park that'll happen on April 25th with the Mark Farringer Dance Project. And they bring in 10 to 15 different dance companies like Robert Moses' Kin, who's based in San Francisco, and a variety of other contemporary dance folks. There's Dimensions Dance Theater in Oakland that's doing a variety of classes from Cuban rumba, which I didn't even know there was such a thing, but there is, to hip hop classes, to West African. There's SJ Dance Co., as I mentioned, that's down at the Eastridge Mall. There's ODC is hosting events, Rhythm and Motion, one of our partners, is doing probably five or six different dance exercise classes that people can check in about. There's so many others. My brain just kind of exploded trying to think of them all.
Well, it sounds very eclectic. So I know the festival kicks off with something called One Dance in Union Square. Can you talk about that and why that's the kickoff event?
Sure. So in the beginning, we thought, well, how can we do something where it brings the community together? We can have some fun. We can have people who could learn something who may not get a chance to kind of perform, if you will. So we came up with this concept in collaboration with Rhythm and Motion and Dudley Flores, the artistic director there, called One Dance. So each year, Dudley selects some songs, does the choreography, and then folks can go online, learn that. There are also free opportunities to come in person and learn it, or you can just show up and wing it, which is also very fun. So it's really kind of that dance party, us coming together saying, hey, here's the kickoff. doing it in a very visible public space. So over the years, we've done it at Union Square, we've done it inside City Hall, we've done it at Yerba Buena Gardens Festival. So we're back to Union Square, which is fitting given the conversation about revitalizing places, public places. And so we really wanted to say, hey, we love the space. We love the idea of accidental audiences, as we like to call it, meaning people will just be walking by and going, huh? What's that? Oh, that sounds amazing. That looks fun. I'm not sure if you remember the craze, the flash mob craze, the mm-hmm. sense of people coming together and learning something. And that's the spirit, that you see all of these people dancing and moving together. It's just an amazing event.
Well, it sounds like a lot of serendipity too, for those who might, as you say, spot something interesting and want to join in. But what would you say to someone who's never danced before and maybe feels a little intimidated?
Sure. It's probably like me going to a Warriors game where I might feel intimidated going into chase. Am I going to know all the terminology? Am I going to know how to fit in? And I think it is about taking that deep breath and going, okay, I'm gonna step into a new space. So our hope is that there is a little bit of like nervousness, because we know that's fun. That's when there's kind of the juice there, if you will, of people going, something feels right about trying this. We're hoping folks will trust their intuition. They'll have that little voice at the side of their head say, hey, go take that class, go to that show. And so this is one of the opportunities. And we've seen people, you know, come back and go to performances and come to different events. So I think the kind of flow of that is what's the amazing part of it.
And you mentioned an event in Union Square. So I understand the city of San Francisco is playing a big role here in Bay Area Dance Week. Can you talk about the partnership with them and how they're involved?
Sure. We have great support from the Mayor's Office of Economic Workforce and Development, who is looking at saying public spaces, it's important for us, not only people who live here in the Bay Area, but those visiting, to see activation, to see the amazing things. I mean, I go out to the Presidio Tunnel Tops, or I go to Golden Gate Park, or to the Academy of Sciences, and I've lived in the Bay Area all my life, and I still am wowed by these places. I'm wowed by downtown San Francisco. So the sense of working with the mayor's office, with San Francisco Rec and Park, who sees it as a full circle moment, as their director said, meaning we've performed there before, the pandemic happened, we had to, like everybody, kind of slow down and stay inside, and now we're back.
Well, I love how you talk about the role of dance in terms of community, and it's obviously troubled times. What are your thoughts about what dance can do, you know, particularly in this moment, or what you hope that this event can do for people right now?
Well, I'm part of many conversations where it's theater and dance and visual artists and musicians. And while this is specific to this festival, we're all talking about the importance of staying visible, staying on our missions, and not feeling like we've got to retract. So I think those are the amazing conversations. In the dance community, I mean, one of the things that I think we could agree upon is often the body is the first thing that gets attacked. Women's bodies, trans bodies. I think one of the things that we do need during this time of kind of chaos and turmoil is being able to come into the body in different ways. And I think that's the beauty that dance classes, workshops, and performances can provide, because you're able to come in another kind of way. And I, you know, great film, great music, great theater, they all do that as well. And dance is just a part of that conversation.
Well, anything you personally are looking forward to, a type of dance that you love to do?
I swim these days. I do a Tai Chi practice, but I go to performances. So for me, it is being able to sit and watch what somebody's birthed in a way. I mean, that seems like such a odd analogy, but is that thing of you've come up with the ideas, you've held it, it's in your body, it's in other dancers' bodies, and then you get to see it realized in so many ways. So for me, it really is any of the performance opportunities that people are doing that just changed my life.
And for listeners who do want to attend or participate in some way, what's the best way for them to get that information and get started?
Yeah, the easiest way is to go to our website, dancersgroup.org, and you'll see immediately things on Bay Area Dance Week. And then you can, again, go to the full calendar of events and select genres, areas, or just scroll through.
So much to choose from. So Bay Area Dance Week runs April 25th through May 4th. All events are free and open to the public. And to check out that full lineup or learn some specific dance moves, you can head to thedancersgroup.org. Wayne Hazard, Executive Director of Dancers Group, thanks so much for joining us. And we hope that listeners join you out there on the dance floor.
I hope so too. Thanks, Ethan.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. You'll never miss an episode that way. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments or even story ideas, give us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan. D Minor was our board operator. And guess what? A replay of this morning's Your Call, guest hosted by Ethan Elkind, is next. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.